Well, last February, my husband, Chuck, and I, and Chuck is here, by the way, in the back row back there, we moved to Flat Rock, downsizing to a fraction of the space we had for storage. We rented a large dumpster and literally filled it with 40 years of our lives. Going through boxes, I came across a yellowed envelope labeled with the words, "Amusing Things to Look Back On." The contents were notes from my last year of college. Several of these notes were from an English professor who had asked me out. I had turned him down. He was many years older than I and not at all attractive to me. Instead of telling him I was just not interested, however, that would hurt his feelings, right? I told him I had to study. So, while I was cloistered away in my favorite carrel deep in the stacks of the library, one of the library aides delivered me a dozen roses with a romantic poem attached and a plea to join the professor for a tennis match in broad daylight. You could call this sexual harassment. He was a professor. I was a student. I was not his student, but as an English major, I took several courses from his friends and colleagues. I really did not think about these things at the time, however. I was rather amused and flattered, convinced that it was chiefly my fine mind and my academic excellence that appealed to him. I kept the flowers. Amusing things to look back on. No, not amusing at all. But maybe because it seemed so, it speaks to a cultural dynamic. How very common it is for men and women to find themselves in situations where being attractive to a person who is in power, even if they are not attracted to them. Being attractive to someone in power, even if you aren't attracted to them, presents awkwardness. Beyond that, there is the confusion and the power dynamic of what happens when the attraction is mutual. Suppose I had wanted to go out with the romantic professor. Wouldn't that give me status among people in the English department? Wouldn't it give me a little piece of power? As we all dredge up memories of what might have been sexual harassment or sexual assault in our past, this example from college is about the best that I can do. Pretty tame. I have no difficulty thinking of a case of sexual discrimination in the workplace, however, that had elements of harassment. It was when I was teaching in high school, coaching a girls' tennis team. I was paid half the amount of the boys' coach, and I was called assistant coach. I coached in the fall, he coached in the spring. When I brought this to the attention of my principal, he said, "Drop it." A young woman at another school had filed a complaint, he said, and had created a lot of trouble. If I pursued it, he said, I would be very, very sorry. Now, we're talking big money here. I got $100, and the boys' coach got $200. He said it had been decided by the county that they could not make the pay equal. I said I would go to the Board of Education, and he offered to pay me the extra $100 under the table. Armed with Title IX, a new prohibition against sexual discrimination in schools, I wrote a letter to the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. That's what it was back then. I had contacted a legal advocate and was ready to take it as far as necessary. The Board of Education ruled in my favor. Now, I revisit this example because it highlights my feelings of indecision regarding how public to make my case. I feared losing my job, and I feared other consequences to myself and my family. I was asked by a women's organization to make this a class action suit. I wasn't willing to carry it that far, to make the sacrifices that would have to be made. I was a coward. I regret that. When the Me Too movement captured the imagination of people worldwide, my first response was, me not. But now I realize that I have trivialized my experiences. And that is a form of denial that enables trivialization of other people's experiences, more serious ones. Anyway, I can understand why Christine Blasey Ford did not come forward earlier. I am deeply grateful for the courage she mustered on behalf of all who are the victims of sexual assault. This sermon is dedicated to her and to all who get past their fears and break through the silence of secrets past. And it is also dedicated to those who cannot yet do that, with a prayer that they may feel held in an embrace of compassion. Now, as Jim mentioned, since 2010, I've had this part-time job with the Unitarian Universalist Association as Consultant for Ethics in Congregational Life. Now, that is a very long title for the person who processes complaints against religious professionals, mostly ministers. I can't talk about cases, of course, but I can make some observations based on 8 years of doing this work. I've completed a total of 7 cases of sexual misconduct, 2 of which went back 15 or 20 years. But the most significant statistic is not how many cases of sexual misconduct I have received, but how many never, ever made it to my desk. Most of the misconduct complaints I've gotten have been filed on behalf of women who had consensual, let me have a glass of water so I can say that word. Consensual sex with their ministers. And most of the ministers and the congregants involved were married. And here is my guess about why we don't get many sexual misconduct complaints. Not only do they not want to expose their own past, some don't even realize that they are the victims of an abuse of power. Maybe they felt special, singled out by the minister whom they trusted and admired. We've been reminded this past week or so that the great silence out there in the land of sexual misconduct is deafening. Because this is not just a matter of ethics in the public domain. It reaches deep into the territory of the human soul. And while I speak of the fears I felt when I was asked to go public with my case, I know that's nothing compared to those of women and men who have been traumatized by sexual assault or sexual harassment, who have been threatened or vilified, who have squelched their rage, who have carried their burdens of pain or shame or guilt for many years. And then there is the Catholic scandal. It's heartbreaking. In a poem that he published in 1975, Chuck Sullivan recalled his experience as an altar boy. This poem is titled, "The Left Hand of God." He writes, "Who could ask for anything more in this world? Coke and popcorn in the movies with the man of my dreams, reaching out to hold me. Not the way it seems, taking a chance to touch me. In the near-deserted matinee's dark silver-screen temptation. It's no wonder, though, that at the time, I didn't understand his hand begging across the seat, dearly dropping in passion's gesture his whole life cheaply in my lap. The poet goes on to describe the whole scene, and I'm going to spare you the details. He describes how, as an adult, he recognized that victim and celebrant were one. And then he concludes the poem. In the prophetic grip of the coming attractions, we rose to leave. And with a look like a prayer for a private intention, you sealed yourself into my life forever. With a secret like a leper who in the heart rent tending leads you to deeply love the healing beauty beneath the sores of the soul's unseemly skin. Who could ask for anything more? This poem disturbs me. It reaches deeply into the soul where a child is not only abused, but he bonds himself with the holy man of his dreams, his abuser. A lot of experiences are evoked when we talk about sexual harassment or sexual misconduct, and power is always a factor. The power of adult over child, boss over employee, teacher over student, violent person over defenseless person, yes. But the most insidious power is the power to engage a person's soul. Who could ask for anything more, writes the poet. This is the voice of a child who will need a lifetime to unravel the emotional trauma of that day in the theater. My last settled ministry was in Santa Barbara, California, where I followed a minister who lost his ministerial fellowship when two women filed complaints against him. And then it came out that there were at least 12 to 20 more women who had sexual relations with him. Now, I could say a lot about this situation, but I just want to say one thing here. There were members of the congregation who were aware of his misconduct for years. When the scandal was made public, because he was a powerful minister of a large congregation, plenty of people defended him. It takes two to tango, they said. Many colleagues came to his defense. After all, he did a lot of good in his ministry. He was a social activist. And to admit that he was unethical somehow discounts those years of trust his people invested in his ministry. But let me tell you this, and I know it. I know it because I served that church for 8 years. The congregation was and is a victim, too. And what makes it worse is they were the enablers, because they were like a family that protects their shameful secret. And here we are now. Thanks to the Me Too movement, the great silence has been broken. Not for the first time, and not for the last. few days ago, a friend of mine in her early 50s was having breakfast in a coffee shop, and the room was overtaken by a loud conversation between people at two other tables, with a table between them. She overheard them all laughing and agreeing, well, every man did stuff like Kavanaugh when they were younger. Well, my friend did not even think before she slammed down her fork and turned to the others. So you mean that every man has attempted rape? And leaving them with mouths open, she walked out of the restaurant. No one was more shocked at her outburst than she was. It rose from a place deep inside of her that said, enough. And I like to think that if my friend had been a man, he might have done the same thing, but he would have added, not me. And I like to think that in virtual coffee shops all over the nation, men and women are standing up and speaking out. This week, we have witnessed a mockery being made of the FBI and our judicial system. A man who was violent toward women has been handpicked to overrule on a woman's right to her own body. The balance of powers that I learned about in my ninth grade civics class is giving way to a fascist display of corrupt executive power governing on behalf of billionaires and intent upon dismantling decades of progress in human rights. 50 U.S. senators, women and men, sold their souls yesterday. Their wimpy political insult has blemished the soul of this country. And like the Santa Barbara Church that was the victim of their own tolerance and bad behavior, their tolerance of bad behavior, our country, our democracy, is the victim here. But we have a power. Alice Walker said, "The most common way people give up their power is by thinking they don't have any." It's easy to think that way these days, isn't it? And it's also lethal. We have a power, and it is the power of justice that fueled human rights movements. It's the power to get out the vote in midterm elections. It's the power of anger that declares enough. It's the power of our faith calling us to be our best selves. It's the power of compassion, sharing the pain of our sisters and brothers. It's the power of courage, ours, courage to speak the forbidden secrets and disempower them forever. We